Okay, we want to continue our study on decisions, decisions, decisions. Tonight, we're looking at, in this particular study, moving out of the book of Acts, though the next two sessions are once again in the book of Acts, but moving to 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verses 12 through 22. You know, life is filled with complexity and with decisions. And life is very complex. We have all kinds of decisions to make, decisions in churches and homes and families and businesses, at schools. And those decisions are not made in a vacuum. We have to consider, or should consider, not only ourselves, but in particular others, and the effect that our decisions will have. In fact, that's in the Old Testament. The whole idea of corporate personality or sense of community that runs throughout much of the Old Testament until you get to the time of Solomon, where that kind of goes by the wayside, is that you were required. It was not only a moral but a religious requirement that you considered the results of your decisions and the effect on other people before you actually did them. Two primary examples of that, well, I guess we could say three, go all the way back to the fall in the Garden of Eden. Those decisions had an effect on the rest of the world, even today. But when Joshua takes over the people of Israel and the leadership of them into the land of Canaan, at the beginning of the book of Joshua, God says, if you lead the people to follow the commandments, if you lead the people to follow the statutes, if you lead the people to be honorable and loyal, then they will take the land. So the positive was, if Joshua did the right thing and thought about it and led the people properly, then there would be good for the people. Conversely, if he didn't, there would be bad. The other side of that happens when, after the battle at Jericho, and the people then go up, I mean, they don't lose a person in that battle, and they go up next to a little place called Hai up in the hills, and they take 3,000 soldiers, because this is just a little bitty podunk town, primarily older people and children. And lo and behold, the first 36 people to die are Israelites, and the rest of them turn tail and run, and everybody's scared to death. And Joshua puts on sackcloth and sits in the ashes, and he goes to God and he says, why'd you let us beat Jericho, and then we can't whip this little podunk town? We've got to go back. Nobody will be afraid of us anymore. And God said, well, Israel sinned. Israel stole and lied. Israel took some of the sacred stuff out of Jericho that I said not to take, except to put it in the treasury of the Lord. Therefore, Israel can't stand before their enemies. And who was Israel? One man, a fellow by the name of Achan, who stole the mantle of Shinar, some shekels of bronze, and a bar of gold. Thought he'd have him a little nest egg when they got there. He'd buy him a piece of property, have him a nice little spread, put him some deer stands up, and some. Hid those things under his tent. When they found out, when Joshua checked around, you know, God didn't say Achan did, he said Israel. When Joshua checked around, found out who had done all of this, and he fessed up, and they found the stuff. They took Achan out to the valley of Achor, and they stoned him to death. Then they brought his family out, and they stoned all them to death. And they brought all his animals out, and they killed every one of them. Then they brought all his possessions and piled them up on top of all that and set them on fire and burned them. And then it took 30,000 soldiers to this little podunk town that had about 5,000 people in it and wiped everybody out. But that one person, when God had said, do not take any of this stuff, but anything that's left, any gold, silver, anything valuable, put it in the treasury of the Lord. Well, when nobody was looking, Achan just, nobody will miss this little small bar of gold and this religious robe and these few shekels of bronze. The effect of one, the decision of one affected the whole nation. They got a whole bunch of people killed. So we don't make those decisions in a vacuum. Decisions we make affect others and vice versa. And our attitudes towards people also affect others and us. In fact, our feelings about each other determine decision-making processes. Well, Paul, and this is a quote here from James Dant, The Apostle Paul suggests in 1 Thessalonians 5, 12 to 22 that although we cannot control our feelings, we can shape our attitudes and responses toward the people and circumstances in our lives. And so in this particular session tonight, we're going to look at attitudes which Paul thinks will aid us as Christians so we can make productive decisions, so we can live a life grounded in peace and love, whether it's at church, at home, in business. So, 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verses 12 to 22. But we appeal to you, brothers and sisters, to respect those who labor among you and have charge of you in the Lord and admonish you. Esteem them very highly in love because of their work. Be at peace among yourselves. And we urge you, beloved, to admonish the idlers, encourage the faint-hearted, help the weak, be patient with them all. See that none of you repays evil for evil, but always seek to do good to one another and to all. Rejoice always, pray without ceasing, give thanks in all circumstances, for this is the will of God in Christ Jesus for you. Do not quench the Spirit, do not despise the words of the prophets, but test everything. Hold fast to what is good, abstain from every form of evil. Have a little bit of background stuff here about Thessalonica and the Thessalonian church. It was a city at the center of commerce. It was at the crossroads of several major trade routes. As a result, there were also many different religions practiced there. A lot of different philosophies and schools of philosophers were in Thessalonica as well. And it was a center of Gentile culture. Most of the members of the church, while there were some Jews there, most of them were converted from Greek mystery religions, Gentile mystery religions. A lot of those from the cult of Dionysus. Dionysus was a dying and rising god whose dying and rising was tied to the seasons of the year. He was also the god of animals and of wine. There was another cult that was an offshoot of that, the cult of Orpheus, and various others as well. So a lot of the folks at Thessalonica are not familiar with the foundations of Judaism, much less Jesus and what Jesus did with that and what God did in Jesus. And we do know from looking in chapter 4 in particular, where Paul, we've talked before about Paul warning the people against sexual immorality and making sure that they take a spouse in the proper way and not in lust, where he talks about people who are busybodies. They've quit their jobs because they think the second coming is going to happen any day, so they quit their jobs and sitting around waiting for Jesus to come. And whether they're little blue-haired old ladies or other folks, you know what happens when they sit around and do that. They stick their nose in everybody's business. And that's what we used to say, all the little blue-haired old ladies. But they're not always blue-haired. And not always old ladies either. But you know, that there were people who had quit the jobs and they were waiting for the second coming any day, and it wasn't happening, so all they started doing then was watching. And so, well, you know, so-and-so did, and they did that. They should have put their shade down last night. You know, all this kind of stuff. Man, idle hands, tool of the devil, idle mind. Doesn't stay idle very long. Sometimes goes off in the wrong direction. And so, all of these kinds of things are going on. And then there were people in chapter 4, he deals with folks who say, okay, well, second coming hadn't happened yet, and friends and family of ours have died. They weren't supposed to do that before the second coming happened. What's wrong? Maybe we're not Christians. Maybe they weren't Christians. So Paul's dealt with some of those things already. And now he comes back here talking with the Thessalonian church and trying to urge them, not only as he's tried to correct them and help them in those areas, but then he says, a lot of this can be solved by your attitude and the decisions you make, the ways you go about doing that in a positive way. Bruce Metzger, who used to be dean of the School of Theology at Princeton University, in writing a book on the New Testament, its background and growth, writes, the Thessalonian church was threatened by social pressure and physical persecution as the pagan community tried to draw them back to the same fruitless life from which they had come. So they're fighting that kind of thing too, decisions to make. And their whether it actually happened or not, in chapter 4, some of the reference of immorality, and not to go back into immorality because you've learned better, may be a reference to some of these mystery religions. Folks have come out of those to Christianity, and friends of theirs said, "Well, hey, we're having a big to do down at the down in the valley for Dionysus, and we're going to have plenty of goat and plenty of wine and plenty of women running around too, because part of that oftentimes involved fertility rites with the temple priestesses and that kind of thing. You know, come on down. You know, then you can go back to your Christian church on Sunday, but we're having this big rally down here and this big party. Come on down." And there's, whether it actually happened or not, there is some sense that at least that was a threat. And so Paul's reminding them here again that they need to make good decisions and not go back to the fruitless life that they had been leading before. The church dealt with all kinds of issues. In chapter 2, Paul talks about integrity of leaders and leadership. In chapter 4, already mentioned personal purity, attitudes toward each other, especially with those who had different ideas about work, and questions about the second coming. In fact, William Barclay says, "The prospect of the second coming had led some to quit their work and wait with a kind of hysterical expectancy, and they had a tendency to despise all authorities, producing a democracy run mad. No authority whatsoever. Whatever anybody wanted to do, they did. Whatever the majority voted for, even by one vote, they did. And there was no... the leadership was falling apart and breaking down. There were also divisions in the church, with some saying that Paul preached the gospel for what he could get out of it, and others, Paul was a dictator. Right, Ed? There are a number of folks out there, including Ed, that think sometimes Paul was somewhat dictatorial. And guess what? Sometimes he was. Sometimes he was. But when it comes to leaders and effective leaders and making decisions, you have to understand that something different was going on in the church. Something different from society, and yet they were seeing in society other things. In first century Greco-Roman society and culture, guess who got the leadership positions? Typically, in politics, in social settings, guess who got the leadership positions in first century Greco-Roman society? And the men who? Money, 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 money. Money. The people who had the money, the people who had the property, the people who had the pedigree. Those were the ones that were given leadership positions. And yet Jesus had said in the church, and a lot of these folks have come out of that kind of setting. And Jesus had even said earlier in the church that in his church, when he talked to the disciples who were arguing over who was going to be the greatest, he said, "Well, you know, Gentiles lord it over them, but it's not to be so among you. The greatest will be servant of all." And so that wasn't the standard in the early Christian community. And so you've got that understanding coming from Paul and others who've come out of Judaism and become Jewish Christians and understand that there's not to be that kind of hierarchy. And then you've got the Gentiles coming in who are the majority, and they're saying, "Oh, but the people who have money and prestige, they're the ones that ought to be the leaders." And so these different groups within the congregation ended up sometimes butting heads with each other. Oftentimes butting heads with each other over that. So there are different groups in the congregation, and they have different attitudes towards each other. And Paul's trying to get them to pull together and to understand the positive ways to make decisions in the church and subsequently also in their lives at home and out in the community, and how to overcome the negative attitudes that they might have. So just some questions to think about, and if someone wants to jump in with an answer or a comment, please do so. I know sometimes y'all find it hard to believe, but I do sometimes get tired of hearing myself talk. So some of the questions: what personal struggles could have contributed to negative feelings in the church? Maybe obviously some of those who didn't have, feeling that those who had kind of took over and ran roughshod over them. What actions by fellow church members contributed to those negative feelings? Well, we could go with all kinds of things. People who tried to do that, people who just decided they were going to quit the jobs and sponge, vegetate. How do actions by others and personal struggles within each of us, within yourself, contribute to difficulties at home, business, school, or even church? Do we have, this is, unless somebody just wants to have confession, this is one of those that you kind of think to yourself, but be open and honest with yourself. Do we have personal struggles within ourselves, sometimes based on our feelings, but sometimes based on the actions of others that contribute to difficulties that we might have at home or at church or at school? Been in a problem, but they make the decisions and they don't consult with the people who have been in the trenches, and then that creates a personal struggle within you when you want to, you know, when something else would be a much better decision, but they don't see it. But then how do you tell them that without feeling threatened? Yeah, it does. That's right, Francis. Opinionated people. They tell you exactly what to think without any filters. Yeah. Without any filters whatsoever. They just, and it's, you know, it's their opinion or nothing. Or only one or two. I've heard that for a lot of my lifetime. Well, I missed the one this past Thursday. So, but although I don't know what I really missed from what I've read about it. Well, you're right, Ed. Sometimes we get so caught up in what we're comfortable with and what we've been taught that the task gets lost in holding on to that. That's true. And that can create issues within ourselves, and sometimes when we want to do, but then we're afraid to speak up or whatever. Yeah. Anger takes over. Well, but anger unchecked eventually shows up one way or another. It's kind of like, and you know, it's kind of like the old saying, if you love somebody, you're going to tell them. If you're really angry or hate somebody, you're going to tell them too. You might show them more. Or you might tell them and then they tell you right back, and then you tell them again, they tell you right back, and next thing you know, somebody's taking a poke at somebody. Them's fighting words, as we used to say. Some of these different groups, though, and some of the things, and I know we don't have any folks like this, but some churches do. You've got those folks who seem to do a lot. The three basic groups he talks about here: those who seem to do a lot, those who seem to do very little, and those who are kind of in between, that he describes as the faint-hearted or fearful and the weak. They sometimes do, but sometimes they don't, and they just kind of, I guess they're doing, it's kind of funny, they rock back and forth, they vacillate. I'm reminded, Bill Cosby used to say, because he was Protestant, his wife was Catholic, and he used to say you could always tell the Protestants in a Catholic service because they didn't know exactly when to stand or sit, so they were doing this stuff that he called the Protestant, he said it's the Protestant rock. Yeah, the Protestant rock. But he says here some of the things that we should look at. to have a respectful attitude towards servant leaders. Now, I know he says here, we appeal to you, brothers and sisters, to respect those who labor among you. What he means here is servant leaders. If they're not servants, if they're not, then why you might treat them with the common courtesy of someone else, but the respect he's talking about is for those who are servant leaders. They prove themselves. They're not afraid to get in there and work. The traits of these, they labor among you. They care about you. In fact, those who labor among you have charge of you and admonish you. Verse 12. Which runs counter to much of the attitude in Paul's 21st century. In Paul's first century culture. Who labor among you, who have charge over you, who admonish you, have respect for them. That kind of runs counter to Paul's culture in the first century. Kind of runs counter to a lot of 21st century culture. I find it more and more these days. It's interesting, though, the Greek word for labor here refers to the act of serving others. And as F.F. Bruce says, labor, have charge, and admonish would better be translated work hard, care, and instruct. Those who work hard among you, those who have charge, that is, they care for you and about you, and those who admonish, that is, those who instruct. Not lord over, but labor among.
Yeah.
Right. To do that recognition and to, you know.
Leaders a lot of times don't do that.
That's true.
And that could cause gossip.
Yeah, it could cause those kinds of things, yeah. It really could, William. And so he says, you know, have that same respect. And what ends up happening is he says that you should, even with the ones that don't do anything or do very little, don't jettison them, but treat them with a sense of care. Don't ignore them. Those who do very little, the people that they're described later as idlers, sometimes the people who do very little, or the ones who are between the groups, the fearful, part of the reason they do it is they reduce their risks of being Christian in a hostile world, or being recognized as a Christian in a hostile world. If I just keep quiet or I don't do anything, then nobody will know and they won't get mad at me. Or they won't raise any questions, or they won't poke fun at me or point their fingers at me because I'm a Christian. I'll just kind of sit in the background and nobody will know. And the thing is, if we do that, and I know we got people in here who have children and who have grandchildren, so I'm trying to make this relevant in a lot of different ways. If we do that, what are we teaching our children? Of course, we do the other and we blast everybody out of the water every time we see them. What are we teaching our children, too? Yeah, that's. But what are we teaching our children if we sit back and we don't do? Or our grandchildren, we sit back and we don't do? I've had a few discussions with my oldest son in the last year because Sydney loves to come to church so much and they're not as regular as they need to be, and she really likes to go to Sunday school and they're not as regular as they need to be. And he says, I know, Dad, but don't, no buts about it. Yeah. But, as I say, but you need to do this. Yeah. But it also depends on how you tell them. Stephen's one of those, if you don't say it the right way, well, David is too. David's even worse. If you say it the wrong way, you've lost a buddy for a long time. But Stephen's got the mind, he's got the memory of an elephant. He'll still remember stuff that was done 20 years ago. Yeah. I said, I forgive you, but I won't forget it. So, you know, it's how we do it. The idlers, though, are people that oftentimes the church is tempted to just kind of ignore. Well, you know, they're not around, so we'll just ignore them. We'll push them aside. Especially in times where there's struggles or difficulties or persecutions. But those are the people that we have to struggle to hold on to because they help define the church. That is, the church is supposed to be a body about caring and nurturing people, if we jettison them just because they don't show up, if we never send them a note or a card or a phone call or don't speak to them in the store, of course they got to speak to us sometimes too, then we are defining the church as a body that doesn't really care. Of course, you can go the other way. I'm reminded of churches around, and there's one in particular. I was talking to somebody yesterday, and they mentioned this particular church, and they said, well, you know, when you go there and you join, part of your membership is, I've mentioned this before, I think, but part of your membership is you agree. You tell them how much you make, and you agree to give a certain percentage of money or a certain amount of money, and if you don't give it after a couple of months, they send you a letter telling you you better give it or you won't be considered in good standing and all this kind of stuff. Do what? Yeah, they do. And it's not just money, but you're expected to like give food. I mean, they have massive storehouses around to help folks too. That I don't know. I've heard that as well. But what Paul says about these is, even though you want to ignore them, even though you want to, admonish them. That is, instruct them, teach them, call them back. Don't ignore them, instruct them. As Dan says, we are called to expend energy on them, although they're not expending any energy on the church. Might be a bunch of those folks on our Sunday school rolls. And what are we supposed to do? Not ignore them. Make a phone call. I know some of y'all do. Send them a note. See them out somewhere. Especially if they're in the crowd. Say, hey, you weren't in church on Sunday. No, you won't see them. And these days, they might be packing and decide to be in the wrong kind of mood. Now, some of you ladies, when you pick up the purse and it's a little heavy, I know why. But he said, you know, even though they are not expending energy on the church, we shouldn't write them off. We should instruct them. We should admonish them. We should contact them. We should let them know that we still care. Of course, it's hard to keep peace when some are doing the work of the church and some aren't, right? It's hard to keep everybody peaceful. Because sometimes we get tired. But Paul said, even in the middle of that, seek to be at peace. Admonish, instruct. Don't jettison, don't run off or run over. And those between the other groups, they're described as the faint-hearted and the weak. Faint-hearted probably means fearful here. They're afraid. Think you might have anybody in church, or have anybody in your business, or have anybody, maybe even family members, that are afraid. They're fearful. Maybe they're faint-hearted. They're fearful about... And I get it a lot more when people realize that they've got a terminal illness. Of course, you know, life's terminal. But they realize they've got a terminal illness. I have more and more folks in the last 10, 15 years of doing things, I have more and more folks that start, well, you know, I wonder if I was good enough. I wonder, should I have done this? Should I have done that? You know, they start questioning whether they were or not. You know, they're faint-hearted. They're fearful. And maybe sometimes we're fearful even before that point. We're not really sure exactly where we fall or how strong our faith is. Or weak. Now, some scholars say that refers to moral. Some say it's spiritual. Some say it's physical or economic weakness. And perhaps here at the church it was some of all of that. Or maybe, there's some people that are whipped by the time they get up every morning. They get up in the morning, they're already whipped for the day. And they're in need of hope and in need of strength, whether it's physically or otherwise. Maybe they need to take some melatonin. I've been told recently that'll help you sleep. I don't know. There's some folks I know that take melatonin. They say they sleep like a baby every night. I said, well, that may or may not be good. It depends on what stage that baby's sleeping. But what are we to do with those who might be faint-hearted or fearful? And sometimes you see it in their eyes and the way they act, not so much them telling you. Paul says, encourage them, nurture them with patience. what do we do? What do we do when Emily or Jackson gets scared at night or some other time? You don't say, "Ah, go live with it," do you? She didn't answer. No, no, she shouldn't. No. Lisa shook her head. No, but you know, you try to nurture them and try to encourage them and put them at ease that they're, you know, there's really not something that lives under the bed. So you can sleep with one foot out. It's not going to grab you and pull you under there. Even though they watched Monsters, Inc. Cute little animated movie. Huh? Monsters live in the closets and come in the room. But, you know, what we do is we try to deal them, nurture them and deal with patience with them and instruct them that there's... And so it doesn't just work. It works in families. It works in businesses. It works in churches. And that's what Paul's calling the church to do. In fact, he is saying the church is the place where patience is supposed to be nurturing toward the idle and the fearful and the weak. How many times do we expect, and I've had students in the past to say, "Well, no, God forgave me, but I'm not going to forgive them." How many times do we expect God's grace and God's tolerance and God's forgiveness for us, but we're not willing to give it to somebody else? Now, I know sometimes patience wears thin. But we're called to at least continue to strive to do that, he says. So what about the attitudes within believers? It demands a choice to produce a good attitude. And yeah, there's another typo. I discovered it earlier today. But before there can be good decision-making, there has to be a certain kind of climate, a certain kind of spirit, especially within a congregation, according to Cecil Sherman, and I would agree. Paul gives us here some positive attitudes for a proper lifestyle decisions. First of all, be at peace. Seek to be at peace. Contentious, fussy people have a difficult time getting in touch with the Spirit of Christ. And I put, do not repay evil with evil. That's when you put a veil over your electronic message. No. Do not repay evil with evil. That's tough to do sometimes. I mentioned fighting words a while ago. Sometimes somebody says something and you not they struck you the wrong way. They're not going to do you one better, and so you say something back, and then they turn around, and they say, and then you say something, and the next thing you know, it's fighting words, repaying evil with evil. But that's our human nature. Somebody hurts us, we strike back. But Paul says, be at peace. And I really think sometimes this is very true. Contentious people have a difficult time really getting in touch with the Spirit of Christ. How often are we contentious? Be patient, he says. Be patient. To be patient with all is perhaps the hardest of all, for the last lesson most of us learn is to suffer fools gladly. William Barclay. I have a hard time suffering fools gladly. And especially some of my colleagues in other places in ministry. When I say, how in the world can you think that? And I don't want to be glad with them. I want to straighten them out. But... And then he gives what I have often called the three basics of Christian living. If we had to put it down, once you accept Christ, put it down to what are we to do? The three foundations, the three basics are 1 Thessalonians 5:16, 17, and 18. Rejoice always, pray constantly, give thanks in all circumstances, and he says, for this is the will of God for you, in Christ Jesus for you. The will of God in Christ Jesus for you is that you rejoice always, pray constantly, and give thanks in all circumstances or situations. Rejoice always. If we rejoice, even if it's not such a good time to rejoice, whether it's in family, business, school, or at church, if we find reasons to rejoice, that shows trust in God. That God will give us what we need to be able to rejoice. Pray constantly. Now, I'm not talking about a laundry list for God, our Santa Claus list, our wish list. Boys, the Sears catalog used to come around Christmas, and they said, oh, the Whoosh book's here. The Whoosh book's here. He had a wish book. It's not a laundry list for God, but it shows confidence in God. Why would you pray to God if you don't have confidence in God? Because it's habit? What's that get you? We should live with an attitude of prayer. Why? Because we have confidence in God. Even though that God will look out for our best, even though it may not always be what we want, we have that confidence that God is there and God is helping us. Just like a child has confidence in a parent until they become teenagers, and then you want to eat them. Right? That kind of confidence. It also reminds us of our need to pray, not only for our needs, but the needs of others. That's part of servant leadership. That's part of servanthood. By the way, if you think that's really tough, I did find a couple of examples. Longfellow, the poet, wrote the words to "I Heard the Bells on Christmas Day." Okay? He wrote it in response to what was going on in the Civil War. "It Is Well With My Soul" was written by Horatio Spafford just after his four daughters had drowned. That's "Rejoice Always, Pray Constantly, and Give Thanks," which involves assessing where we are and where we could be while relying on God. Whether that decision is a decision we make at church, a decision we make in business, a decision we make at home. Now, it's a whole lot easier to talk about this stuff than to actually do it, because we have to think about it to do it, right? But then he gives some negative commands to us as well. Do not quench the Spirit. That is, don't try to take control of things by stifling the Spirit, or my addition, or the good spirit that's within other people. And sometimes somebody can have a good spirit and we just stomp on it and mash it and twist it and tear it up and toss it in the trash can. It's also trying to be in total control of all that happens, which limits what the Spirit can do and what the human spirit can do. So don't quench the Spirit. That helps us maintain trust in God. Do not despise the prophets. Now, that doesn't mean that you go out and read everything Edgar Cayce ever did. Certainly don't listen to everything Ernest Angley says or some of these others. Don't try to overrun the prophets. The role of the prophet was to build up or edify and encourage. But a lot of times, the prophet, whether it was the priest, the prophet, the king, the preacher, the rabbi, they were pushed and overrun by the contentious folks or those who were used to being in charge because of their position or their money, etc. Abstain from every form of evil. That is, don't try to take control through, and I put evil in quotation marks. Evil means that is wrong intentions. If we try to take over things and run things with the wrong intention, that's an evil intention. If you decide a way to punish a child and straighten them out is to glue their hands to the wall, that's an evil intention. Y'all saw that on the news the other day? A woman glued her child's hands to the wall. I need to glue her lips together. But now that was being contentious, wasn't it? As we're paying evil for evil, that's right. But you know, don't do things out of wrong intentions, but always seek to do them out of the proper intention. And then he says, test everything and hold fast to what is good. That is, analyze everything. You know, the Bible is full of morality stories. It really is. As Cecil Sherman says, the prophets told stories about a moral God who gave moral commands and wanted to amend people's conduct so they would become moral. We're to test everything, to analyze everything, even the Bible. And while we do it, we're called upon to do it individually, we're also called upon to do it together. And when we analyze it together, we can be teaching similar things and understand, and we can gain insight from others. And then when we analyze it individually, we can come up with insights that are meaningful to us and then share them with other people. Sunday school. Another plug, Betty. Sunday school. And the teacher isn't the only one who has things to say. I know some of y'all don't let them sometimes because you discuss, and that's good. Business. School. At home. Because you get those interpretations. You want your children to learn those good lessons. And so you share those with them as well. Or your grandchildren. Look at biblical stories. For the early Christians, what God said was good in the past was still considered good. And what God said was evil in the past was still considered evil. And they learned those things and they taught them to their children. They taught them to their children. Retain what is good. You know, Jesus expounded on the Mosaic Law and raised the bar as to what is good, which goes back to what's in your heart, your attitude. Retain what is good and good for the whole, and reject what is bad. Don't just think about self, but think about what are my thoughts, what are my actions, what are my words doing to somebody else? How are they affecting someone else? And remember, really, we choose our feelings and our responses. Oh, but they made me mad. Yeah, but we chose to be mad, right? We could have chosen otherwise. We choose our feelings. And we choose how we're going to react. You know, there's some people that bring a smile every time they come in the room. There's some folks that when they're not there, everybody goes, phew. But where we respond and how we respond starts inside. It starts internally. And we choose our feelings and how we're going to respond. They hurt my feelings. Well, they might have, but then how I respond is my choice. And Paul asks us to choose carefully and wisely. Test everything, hold fast to what is good, abstain from every form of evil. Choose wisely. I can't ever say that without thinking about Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, where the guy looking for the cup of Christ, and he drinks out. Oh, it's got to be. And then he shrivels up to it. And the knight that's guarding all those cups says, he chose poorly. We're to choose, but choose wisely. And what's really a tough assignment, we should always act Christian. Usually we say, we should always act like a Christian. Well, no. If we act like a Christian, then maybe that means we're not really Christian, we're just imitating and acting like. We should always act Christian. That is, seek to understand and to live the mind of Christ. Have this mind which is yours in Christ Jesus, that though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men. He was obedient unto death, even death on a cross. That's humility. That's service. And that's a tough assignment. But our attitude affects the way we live, but our attitude affects the decisions we make and how we make those decisions. What we choose to do, whether it's church, home, school, or business, what we choose to do. So the questions with which we are left here at the end, and I know choir practice is getting ready to start in 10 minutes. But just kind of to think about, if you want to talk about them some, we can, but kind of think about, how do we choose and respond to our leaders? Church, home, business? How do we relate to inactive members, or what I call the sometimers, or creasters? Yeah. How do we relate to them? Do we just kind of out of sight, out of mind? How can we encourage others to be more active in the various opportunities of our church? Both the inactive members, you know, the sometimers, and even those who might come regularly, but they really just kind of are on the fringes of what happens. You know, how can we encourage them so that they can make decisions to do so? How can we make decisions uncluttered with preconceptions? That's a tough one. We approach all kinds of things with preconceived notions. I know I do. how do we combat control issues at home as well as at church? I know some, in some instances at home we can sit them in the corner or lock them in the room or whatever. But how do we combat control issues at home as well as at church in a positive way, a productive way? And then what patterns of church participation do our children and grandchildren and neighbors' children witness in and trough our lives? That should be through. Even sometimes as a two-finger typist, I hit the wrong keys. But what patterns of church participation, notice I didn't say just church attendance, but church participation, do our children, our grandchildren, or our neighbors' children witness in and through our lives? The decisions we make there. I hope maybe this week you'll reread 1 Thessalonians 5, 12 to 22, and think through some of these things. As we try to think about the decisions we make, how we make them, and why we make them, and what's important about them. Not just for us, but for the good of the world around us. Even though Paul was contentious at times. Right, Ed? Thank you. God bless you. Go in peace. I look forward to seeing you this week. Amen.